Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. So how do you feel about money? Would you characterize yourself as an aggressive or conservative investor? How much of your money do you give to charity? How much do you worry about your finances? How you answer those questions could be influenced by where you work and what you do for a living. It might not come as a shock that hedge fund traders think about money a little bit differently than clergy do, but what about salespeople who earn money on commission versus financial advisors, fundraisers, and debt counselors? They all deal with money. It's key to the work that they do, and yet their attitudes towards it can be quite different. Temple University sociology professor Kevin Delaney has been exploring what he sees as money cultures produced by the economic conditions associated with various jobs. And he's concluded that what you do for a living and maybe even the people you do it with can in some way influence how you think about money. He lays out this conclusion in his new book, Money at Work, On the Job with Priests, Poker Players, and Hedge Fund Traders. Kevin Delaney, welcome to Focus.
Hi, Craig. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Glad to have you with us. And as we begin our discussion about how our work shapes our attitudes towards money, we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Kevin, I guess a good place to start is to ask you how your personal attitudes towards money maybe have been impacted by some of the work that you've done in your career.
Well, that's only a fair question, and I have thought about that a bit. And one of the things I've noticed over the course of my career and what really got me interested in framing the book the way I did is that depending on the type of job I was doing at a particular time in my life, I found my attitudes toward money and just what I was thinking about in terms of money shifted quite a bit. So, for example, if I think back to the early part of my career when I was in college, I worked, for example, as a toll collector on a highway. And it was a very interesting job. You might find it surprising that it was interesting, but it was an interesting job. This was in the days before automated Easy Pass and things like that. And so I was sitting out on a highway in a toll booth and collecting a lot of money from the cars that would come by. And then whenever we were on breaks, we would be at the little house on the side of the highway, and we'd have to count our money and put it in a locked bag and all of that. And I noticed in that job that people talked about money all the time. Maybe that's not a surprise. We would have stacks of dollar bills in front of us. But we talked about money in a very, very specific way, and that is that I noticed that toll collectors often sat around talking about schemes to steal money. And I found that interesting, and I always wondered why they talked about that so much, because I never actually saw any toll collector in my life steal any money. They talked about it a lot, and I think there were a combination of things about the job that made people talk like this. First, we were around concrete money all the time, stacks of dollar bills, and we had a lot of time to talk about it. But also, I think the job alienated you a bit from money in that you were taking dollars from people constantly in which you had no relationship with these individuals. You only talked to them for a brief second or two. And it wasn't always patently obvious as to who that money belonged to. I mean, at some level, we knew it belonged to the state government. But it was kind of a bunch of money that we were collecting, taking in, putting into a bag, filling out forms, and dropping it into a safe day after day after day. So people had a lot of time to think about how to scheme about getting that money. But then I noticed a second thing, Craig. I noticed that people also told a lot of stories about prior toll collectors that had gotten caught in various schemes about taking money. And I began thinking of those as sort of cautionary tales to remind one another that this money really did belong to somebody, and somebody clearly would notice if any of it was missing, and you really ought not to risk your job doing it. So that was one of the first jobs where I thought about money in very stylistic ways. I felt like we were in this money culture in which we were dealing with very concrete versions of money in a very alienated fashion, and it led to certain types of ways of thinking about money. Then after that job, I was a bartender, and maybe many of your listeners might have worked in service jobs as waiters or waitresses or bartenders, and it won't come to any surprise to them that you think about money in a very different way when you're collecting tips. And so we would constantly think as bartenders about how to increase our tips and how to get more money from the the customers. And then, since we were paid in cash, money was always burning a hole in our pocket. So the culture that you're in when you're in the service industry in restaurants and bars is to go out after work with other bartenders and other waiters and waitresses, and you would tip very heavily to sort of honor your brethren in the industry. And there was no talk of long-term savings. None of us had 401k plans or retirement plans, let alone health insurance. So we were very immediate in how we talked about and spent money. It was a very cash kind of business. People talked about whether they should report their tips to the IRS or not, and it was a whole different way of thinking about money. Now, I'll jump ahead a little bit to later jobs in my life. Now I work as a vice dean administering academic departments, and I find myself in meetings all the time talking about things like, should we invest money in our classics department or our psychology department, and how do we measure the payoff of that investment? Well, now we're talking about money with time frames that are often 5 to 10 years in the future, that are very abstract, where the measurement is very difficult. And it's no surprise that people in those jobs talk about money in very abstract and long-term ways. We talk about 401ks. We talk about planning for our retirement. It's a very different kind of money culture. So that's just a few ways in which different jobs I've had affected the way I've thought about money.
Well, and before we delve too deeply into this, one of the big questions I have is whether or not certain careers have within them certain cultures, or whether or not people have certain personalities that veer them towards certain careers, and so that's why there seems to be these cultures.
That is the ultimate question, and it's a question I really struggled with sorting out in the book. And fundamentally, it is impossible to truly sort out that question unless you were really allowed to do a true scientific experiment where you took a random group of 30 people and made them hedge fund traders for the rest of their life, and another 30 people and randomly made them priests. Our ethical committees at universities still don't let us do those kind of things. So you can't really get that kind of a controlled experiment in which you separate out personality from the job itself. So what we're left with in the real world is a mixture of the two things. And I think you are right that people with certain personalities are attracted to certain types of jobs. Many hedge fund traders are quite aggressive in their ways of approaching money, for example. So personality does lend you to certain types of jobs, but the jobs themselves then start to work on you, and they also affect that personality, sharpen it or warp it or change it. It's also true that people who enter fields in which their personalities are really poor matches for the job often tend to leave that job after a certain amount of time because there's just a mismatch. But I do think it is still true that despite this attraction of certain personalities to certain types of jobs, that there are real things that I could observe happening in my research in these jobs that shape people into the type of people they are. So one way to put it is a hedge fund trader is as much made as they are born. They might be born with a certain personality, but they're also made into hedge fund traders. And I could watch that, for example, in the hedge fund trading rooms that I spent a lot of time observing and in the interviews I conducted with hedge fund traders. And that is, they learn a certain lingo. They experience a certain set of things that train them to think about money in a certain way. For example, many hedge fund trading firms put a lot of work into training hedge fund traders into being hedge fund traders. There's a very well-known firm in the Philadelphia area that actually takes its novice hedge fund traders, brand new recruits, and brings them to racetracks and teaches them about risk, about game theory, about informational advantage through betting on horses. They also sponsor poker tournaments, and they teach hedge fund traders who don't already know how to play poker, because there's some commonalities between poker playing and hedge fund trading. And I think it's no coincidence that there are many hedge fund traders that play poker. So there are certain things that get taught in various professions. To jump to a very different profession, fundraisers, I actually went through some training myself as a fundraiser, as part of the research for the book, so I could learn how fundraisers are made, not just born. And very few people are born into life saying, I want to be a fundraiser someday. They usually have other professions first. And then they go through training to learn how to be comfortable around other people's money and how to ask people for money, and that doesn't come naturally for a lot of people. And there is a way to learn how to do that through the money culture around fundraising. So it's a long answer to your question, Craig, but I think it is both personality and experiences at work that make us into who we are in the ways we think about money.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the relationship between money and work with sociologist Kevin Delaney. He's a professor of sociology at Temple University and also vice dean for faculty affairs at Temple. He's also the author of the book Money at Work, On the Job with Priests, Poker Players, and Hedge Fund Traders. We'd like to know whether you think what you do for a living and who you work with impacts your attitude towards money. Do you think about money differently because of the kind of work you do? Let us know. We also welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu or you can again call 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Of course, you can also post comments or questions on WILL's Facebook page. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. So we already heard a few examples that you've cited, Kevin, of professions that you examined, folks that you spoke with, to get a sort of sense of these different attitudes towards money in different careers. In the development of this book, as you conducted all these conversations, how did you conclude which professions to examine?
That was tricky as well. What I wanted to do was pick professions in which money played a central role. I don't believe all professions are created equal in this regard. There's some professions where money plays a much less central role and probably doesn't affect the incumbent's view of money nearly as significantly as the professions I studied. I wanted to look at professions in which people handled a lot of money, talked about money a lot, or money played a very interesting and different kind of role in the work people did. So I was constantly on the lookout for professions in which money might enter into that profession in some interesting way, although the way it enters the professions I studied could be very different one from another. And then as I began studying those professions, I sometimes found interesting pairings, and that's how the chapters are organized around various pairings. There were sometimes professions that I never really thought would go together, but I found that there were certain structural features of those professions that made people in them sound very much alike. For instance, I did not go into the book thinking of pairing professional poker players and hedge fund traders, but I found so many interesting commonalities between the two that I ended up comparing them. So all of these people are money handlers in some way. They handle money at work in a significant way, or they think about money in a significant way. And I ended up pairing ones that often went together. I paired, for instance, commission salespeople with sports and entertainment agents because I discovered that both were selling something and both had to think very deeply about how they spent their time and how they were best able to turn their time into money. For commission salespeople, that could be somewhat obvious, that people who are paid on commission are often thinking about whether they're spending their time well and whether they're talking to the right customers who are giving them the most commission. But I found that sports agents had a similar way of talking about their time and money, and I realized that was because they were selling something too. They were selling the embodied talent of their clients, and they would often invest huge amounts of their own time in clients that never paid off. So they had to think very carefully about how to split their time among clients in the hope that one or two clients might hit the jackpot, for lack of a better word. But they would spend a lot of unpaid time with other clients that never did get a record contract or an athletic contract or a book contract. So I noticed that when I talked to commission salespeople and sports and entertainment agents, they often, within a few minutes of my conversation, began talking about this very interesting alchemy of time equaling money that is very complex in those professions and seems to occupy their consciousness a good amount of their working day. And then that spills over into their private life. Some of the book that I've written is also about how our work spills over into private life, and you often found commissioned salespeople and sports and entertainment agents struggling with the boundaries between their own work time and their private or leisure time. I noticed a lot of commission salespeople would talk about arguments with their family members, their partners, or their children about whose time they were on. Were they on work time or were they on home time, and who had a right to their time? So that is how I chose the professions, each one representing a very interesting way in which money enters into work.
We have a couple of folks on the line waiting to talk with you. We'll start this morning with Steve in Watsika. Steve, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. Great topic. Very interesting. Just a couple of brief comments and thoughts. My wife works for a bank and handles money, huge amounts of physical money every day. And it's interesting because there had been some talk in the society as far as moving to a money-less society. But physical money is probably one of the filthiest things you can think about if you're dealing with huge amounts of paper money. I read someplace that they thought 90% of most of the paper money in the United States had some sort of remnants of cocaine on it or something. It's a bizarre thing when you deal with physical money, huge amounts of it every day. It just, you know, I think it kind of jades your perspective.
Yeah, it does something to you.
Yeah. And the other quick comment I have, and I'll offer up to your guest, is my dad told me years ago, he said the hardest thing to do is if you have a lot of money and then you lose it, the change in your lifestyle. And where I'm going with this is there was a story last week about this girl who played on the show Happy Days. I think her name was Erin Morin. Mm-hmm. And she just recently got kicked out of a trailer camp in Indiana. She's homeless. And you compare that to Ron Howard, who is now, you know, a famous movie star, actor, director, probably a multimillionaire, and then just how their perspectives and their life styles have changed over time. And I'll offer that up and listen off air. Thanks.
All right. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, Steve, for those comments. Very interesting. And I did see that article on Erin Morin from Happy Days. But I'll start first with the physical money. I think you're right about that, and it was what I experienced as a toll collector, too, touching a lot of physical, filthy money, as you put it. And it does seem to do something to you when you're around that much physical money. You made the comment, Steve, that a lot of people predict we're moving to a moneyless society, and I think that is a little bit of an overrated sort of view, that we still deal with physical money a lot. And as we move towards more electronic money, I found, ironically, that it actually allows people to put more meaning onto money rather than less, because once people start dealing with alternative types of money, they can envision all sorts of things for that money that they might not have envisioned when it was physical. So I'll just leave that for you to think about a little bit. Having had money and lost money is one of the most challenging things, because you've sort of tasted a top shelf life and then have to go back to having no money. And I think poker players were one group that I interviewed where people had experienced this, where there's a sort of boom and bust cycle that can happen to poker players. Many poker players spend some time in which they're completely down and out and don't have any money. And I think it can be particularly hard for them if they had a time where they were doing very well. I think you're right. Your reference group has changed, and suddenly you've experienced the good life and then have no money. That can be very, very difficult on people. I think any kind of jarring change in one's economic circumstances could be hard. With poker players, the funny thing about poker players is they can have a night in which they win $20,000, and then they can have another night just a day or two later in which they lose $20,000. And in essence, they're in exactly the same place where they started. But something very funny has happened to them. They were up $20,000 and then down $20,000. They've essentially had $40,000 pass through their hands in a short period of time. And this does make you kind of lose track of money. So many poker players are known for giving a $100 tip to the pizza delivery guy, or there's a famous story of a poker player that got a water bill for $5,000, just paid it without any awareness that that was an odd amount of money to owe for a month's worth of water. You can lose track of the value of money when so much of it goes past you each and every day.
Well, you know, one of the other things that you point out in the book is how people in different walks of life are asking themselves different questions about the amount of money they have, you know, in their bank account.
So
you may have some who are asking, and I guess hedge fund traders might fall into this category, how much more money do I need to make in this industry before I get out, versus others who say, how much money do I really need, or how much can I live without?
Yes, it's kind of amazing how different we are about that question. I found some hedge fund traders that sort of only half jokingly said that $10 million might not be enough. I quote one that says, I used to think $10 million was enough to walk away, but I like boats, and now I think $10 million isn't enough. He was sort of half joking, but he was getting at that idea of, now that I've seen $10 million, $10 million still might not be enough. And, you know, we do live in a culture where we're told all the time that in order to retire, we need at least $1 million. Lately, I've been seeing people say $3 million is what you need to retire comfortably. Yet then I ran into another person I talked with who did this missionary work, and his goal in life was to give up as much of his money as possible. And he tried to take lower and lower salaries in each job he took. And his express interest was to be more like and more in common with the people he met in Africa and other places in which he went on these reverse mission trips. And he had come to believe that shedding money was the key to his own happiness, and that fits into a long line of ascetics who want to give things up to find true meaning in life. So he made the point to me, which I thought was very profound. He said, you know, I spend time in parts of the world where there is no concept of retirement, let alone a retirement that requires $3 million to enjoy. In societies in which people are much more dependent on one another and interdependent, there isn't this view that you have to have enough money to get complete independence from everybody else in order to survive. Now, I don't blame people in the United States for feeling they need that much money to retire comfortably. It is because we live in a society in which we do not take care of one another in extended families or extended tribal communities or neighborhood groups that we feel we need so much money to just retire comfortably and live out the rest of our lives. So you're right that people are asking such different questions even of themselves, and that comes out of the type of work they do. They ask, how much longer can I keep this up? How much money do I need to retire? How much money do I need to have a comfortable life? How much money do I need to feel successful? Your very asking of those questions can differ depending on the type of work you do, let alone the answers you come up with in those kind of jobs.
Among the professions that you know, folks you spoke with enjoy that I found interesting were folks that fell into those categories of salespeople and financial advisors.
Right.
And there's a real contrast there, and yet there are people, and my own family, in fact, who are both.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, first of all, talk about what the different attitudes are for salespeople versus financial advisors, and then talk a little bit about if there's some sort of dichotomy maybe in our brains when it comes to this stuff.
I think it was interesting that most of the financial advisors I interviewed and spent time observing tended to advise high net worth individuals, people with a fair amount of money. I did interview a couple who were just starting out, and so they were advising people with maybe a slightly lesser income, but sort of by definition, someone coming to a financial advisor tends to have some amount of money. And what a lot of the financial advisors are doing is they're trying to discipline themselves into this idea of trying to hit singles rather than home runs, and they're talking, and by that they're talking about diversifying portfolios, helping people get ready for retirement and all that. Yet they encounter clients who can have all different ideas about what they want done with their money. There can be some clients that want to be very aggressive with their money. There can be some clients that haven't saved enough money despite having very high incomes in their life and are trying to catch up by pushing the financial advisor towards delivering a return of 10% or more on their money. And many of the advisors feel uncomfortable taking that much risk with their clients' money. So they're both trying to manage their clients' expectations and stick to this kind of disciplined investing and diversification. But I found it funny that a couple of the investment advisors would tell me their own cautionary tales about how they themselves fail to take their own advice. And I think because they're around so much investment and so much money, and they're around people with much more money than they have, they all, almost all of them, said once or twice in their career they had failed to take their own advice of trying to hit just singles and had swung for the fences and made a big-time bet on some risky investment. And several of them had gotten burned a bit by that and said it was an important lesson in their own career. Now, the salespeople who are many of the salespeople I interviewed were product salesmen. I had a lot of connections into the food and beverage industry, so they were selling a lot of very kind of stable products, if you will, sort of concrete products. And they were always trying to build their client base to build their own income level and then invest their own money. But another group I'd like to mention are the debt counselors, because they were also advising people about money, just like investment advisors were, but they were not talking to high net worth individuals. They were talking to people that had run into money problems and maybe were one step away from a bankruptcy filing. And there, the investment advisors, or debt counselors in this case, talked very differently to people about money. There, they would have their clients keep spending diaries to record every penny they spent during a week or a month's period of time. And then they would go over that diary with the person and try to locate their areas of money problems. And they might question the person even on spending money on a cup of coffee out at a store or a delicatessen, let alone a Starbucks. And they would use the psychological language of spending problems and try to get them to cut back even a small amount of discretionary spending that they were doing. So their lives became subject to being kind of an open book for the debt counselor to really try to look at every bit of money they were spending.
Let's take another call. We have Michael on the line from Effingham. Michael, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. Could your guests do some analysis about professionalism, class society, and the entrepreneurial attitude that's swaying now, and reality? Half the population in this country lives in poverty, and around the world it is even higher. Thank you, and I'll listen on the radio.
Thank All right, thanks.
Yes, thank you, Michael. A lot of the groups I looked at did have a strong element of professionalism in them, if you by that mean coming out of a professional association, having the traditional hallmarks of a profession. And it is often the professional training that begins this money culture that they exist in. And there is a certain conceit, maybe, is the best word I can come up right now with, when you are in a profession and earning, you know, above the median income for people in the United States, there's a certain discretionary income, there's a certain ability to plan for the future, there's a certain comfort level in knowing that retirement is a possibility, there's a certain security in putting away money in a 529 account for your children's education. All of that kind of long-range planning is much more possible for people in those sorts of jobs, although I will say that the culture of fear and insecurity has gripped everyone since the financial crisis, and even some of the professionals I talked with felt very, very worried about their future, and we could always talk more about that. But for the people who are living closer to the edge, who are in poverty or going to debt counselors and things like that, they simply don't have the comfort to be able to really plan much for the future. They're thinking about the day by day. And there, they are often even in deficit mode, where they're thinking about how to pay off debt, how to pay off bills, how to juggle a set of bills that are in front of them where they might not have the money to even pay the monthly expenses. And there, the stress level is much, much higher around money. And sometimes you even wish to you want to avoid talking about money because there's no pleasure in any of those conversations or thought processes.
I've also heard research conversations with people at various income levels that there's this concept that if someone is really focused intently on the dollars that are coming in, and that, you know, very low income level, or, you know, really struggling financially, that they have a tendency when it comes to consumer purchases to only purchase that which they need in the moment, even if it's to their financial detriment.
Yeah, I think there may be some truth to that, though I will add to that, sometimes that's your best and only choice. You may be in a neighborhood where it's hard to get to anything else, so sometimes that does happen. You buy in very small quantities, for example. But part of that, I think, is the realistic constraint you're under. You simply don't have enough actual physical money to buy the larger size or something that might, in unit price, be worth more to you in the long run, or you don't have the ability to store it, or you're just too busy to do that. So I think there are some good explanations for why people might act that way. And if you go into markets in low-income communities, often things are in very small sizes where people might pay a dollar for something because they have that dollar at the moment, and actually in terms of unit pricing, they're paying more than if they were able to go to a Sam's Club or a BJ's or a wholesale club or something like this. But you can understand why they need to sort of operate that way. They may operate in a completely cash economy. They don't have credit cards. They may not even have a debit card, so they have to do that. But it is one of the sort of added costs to being poor.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is this idea that if you are used to a certain environment,
mm-hmm.
that whatever those habits may be in terms of earning money, spending money, are likely potentially to continue even if you find yourself in a different environment down the road.
I see. That may be true, because it is a money culture. I mean, you do grow up in a certain type of money culture, and it does affect us for our whole lives, even if we gradually start to move away from it. I think of my own experience growing up. I grew up in a working-class family, a rather large family. Neither of my parents went to college. We dealt with money in very concrete ways. My parents were afraid of credit cards to some degree, and so they operated more in a cash society. And they did it as a way to sort of control their own spending. My father, it always amazed me, my father would have as much taxes taken out of his paycheck as he possibly could in a way to enforce spending so that at tax return time, he'd get a big refund and he'd be able to use that money to do, say, a home repair or take us on vacation. Now, myself, as a professional who has a college education, has gone on to graduate school, I realize that's a very, I'm putting it in quotation marks, dumb financial move, because you're giving the government a tax-free loan of your own money for a long period of time. But if I think about why my father did that, it was good reason. He didn't have a bank account. He didn't have other ways to save money. So he was finding a way to force himself to save a big chunk of his paycheck under that old idea of if you never see the money, you don't spend it. So if he had those taxes taken out, he would claim essentially zero deductions, so that when he could have claimed seven deductions, so that a large amount of money was taken out of his paycheck, so it would be there in April when he filed his tax return. So that those lessons are still with me, Craig, even though I've grown away from that and become an adult myself. There are still ways in which I'll find myself doing enforced savings and things like that. I'll let you in on a little secret. I still walk around my campus in Philadelphia with my eyes down, picking up pennies that I find on the ground and things like that. Yeah. I have to think that comes from my upbringing, not from my current situation.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is sociologist Kevin Delaney, author of Money at Work, On the Job with Priests, Poker Players, and Hedge Fund Traders. We're discussing the relationship between money and work, and we welcome your thoughts on the subject. Specifically, do you think about money differently because of the kind of work you do, or perhaps because of the prevailing wisdom of the people you work with? Let us know. We also welcome any other questions or comments you may have about the relationship between the money you earn and the work that you do at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. It's time for a short break. This is Focus.
The loss of a General Motors plant would throw any local economy into a tailspin. Remember the plant closing in Tilton, Illinois? As Goes Janesville, our next community cinema screening, looks at how Janesville, Wisconsin dealt with their loss when the General Motors plant closed in 2008. The free public screening is at the main Champaign Public Library, Tuesday, October 9th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m.
Support comes from the Ethics Core Team, organizers of Ethics Awareness Week at Illinois, October 8th through 12th. Topics include student academic integrity, ethics in teaching, social responsibility in science, and more. Information at ethics.granger.illinois.edu.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're discussing the relationship between money and work with sociologist Kevin Delaney. He's a professor of sociology at Temple University and the author of the book Money at Work, On the Job with Priests, Poker Players, and Hedge Fund Traders. We'd like to know whether you think what you do for a living and who you work with impact your attitudes towards money. Do you think about money differently because of the kind of work that you do? Let us know. We also welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And Jeff has been waiting very patiently in Morris, Illinois. Jeff, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. Did you know that money is the root of all evil? I had to bring that one up. I think what is going on in our country nowadays is, you know, you're talking about, I want to say money and time. I'm into trades, and I cannot save enough. I know people that are retiring. I know people that have retired for a while, and you can't save enough because of the way the economics of this country is, in the world in general, is working. I firmly believe we're going to go back to that. And some, you were bringing this up earlier about the money aspect. Me personally, I think we're going to get to a point in our country. We're going back 150 years, and maybe bartering.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do a lot of bartering right now.
Yeah.
I don't make a lot of money, but my life has been not wrapped around making money because I've seen what happens to people when they have it. Now, the 90s kind of blew this country out of the water when it comes to people making big money off of finances, and you know, it would seem to be the one decade that people, you know, companies and people in the stock market and whatnot made money. I don't know how, if you see that play, but I think what happened is when we turned the century, a lot of that got turned upside down in our head. And because people weren't smart with their money, I think now we're paying the price. And I think, unfortunately, everybody in this country is going to pay the price for a few.
All right. Well, tell you what, I'm going to stop you there just because one of the comments that you made dealing with bartering really does apply directly to something that, Kevin, you wrote in your book about, in particular, I believe it was clergy who sort of engage in a lot of bartering. That's sort of a common thread in all of the clergymen that you spoke with.
Yes, I found that in clergy, and I also have a chapter in the book on people that are doing experimental things with money, like bartering. So I found it interesting that Jeff is doing more of that. I'm seeing a real increase in that among people. So let me say something about clergy first. There are many clergy that kind of exist in an economy without a lot of money. They operate in a gift economy where people give gifts. Priests often receive gift cards and things like that and use that to buy clothing because they don't get a very large stipend in their job. But they also have many concerned others that barter and do things for them. I interviewed a clergy person who runs a church in a very poor neighborhood near Philadelphia, and he has a huge network of friends, many of them in the building trades, who basically come and help him keep this very old church running. So when it failed a fire code inspection, he just put out the word to his friends, and they came and they inspected it and redid the sprinkler system and all that without any money ever changing hands that I was aware of. So clergy are one example of living in this. But I also found secular people doing this. There are a number of places, some of your listeners may know of these, that use alternative currencies. They print their own money and use it as a form of barter. In the new electronic economy, people are doing time banking, where they set up websites in which they can trade their time with one another. They'll do babysitting in exchange for painting and things like that. And one of the more fundamental statements I heard in the book is our problem in our society is not the lack of skills nor the lack of need. It is often simply the lack of money. If money is that universal lubricant for these things happening, sometimes there just isn't enough lubricant in the system to keep it going, and we have to think of alternative ways to do that. So Jeff is onto something, and if you think of things like the free cycle movement, where people are not just recycling, but free cycling, giving things to one another free, or setting up networks in which you can drop off free things that you don't have a use for anymore, we could go back in some of our subcultures into a society, as Jeff put it, where money is not so essential. And what happens when you do that, you might notice, is that transactions can become a little less efficient, but they also become more personal. People come to know one another better when they're trading skills. One of the great things about barter is that you have to know what another person needs, and they have to know what you need. In a money economy, that's less true, because money becomes the universal currency that you can trade for anything. So in barter economies, people often are not atomized in actors who don't know one another. They're instead become friends, and they know each other and will help each other as human beings. So I did find many people starting to do more types of bartering, and it was another irony of our new technological age that it doesn't just make us more anonymous, it could actually create ways in which we can connect with one another as free cyclers. So there are more and more experiments like this in which money in its traditional sense is necessary.
Some workplaces feature combinations of the sorts of professions that you examined.
Yes.
You might have commissioned salespeople working for a financial advisor, or professional fundraisers working for a CFO who focuses on investments.
Yes.
If their attitudes towards money are somewhat different, as it would seem to be the case, according to your book, does that potentially create challenges to working together effectively and towards the same goals?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest clashes that you see very frequently is between commissioned salespeople and the accounting staff. The commissioned salespeople are out there hustling, and they know how hard it is to get new sales or to increase sales or to find a new customer. So if you look at an industry like the restaurant industry, where I interviewed a lot of people selling food to the restaurant industry, you are desperate trying to get new work. And so because restaurants fail quite often, they can sometimes be risky. Well, meanwhile, back in the home office, you have people trained as accountants and financial analysts and risk managers and all that sort of thing. They're trying to put brakes sometimes on the salespeople who want to move product and gain commission, while the accountants are worried about the financial risk they're taking on. So it's very common to put customers on stop order, which means that you don't let your salesman place any more orders with that person because maybe they're 60 or 90 or 120 days behind in their payments. So you have a clash of money cultures there. You have commissioned salespeople that are becoming friendly with the restaurateur. They know that they're taking a risk. They know that they're trying to sell product. They're trying to increase commission. They know that the restaurateur needs fish or meat or vegetables to be open that night. And you have the green-eyed shade person back at the home office that's saying it's no good to sell this product to someone if we're not going to get paid. So there is the perfect example of a clash. You also, though, can have it in investment advising, where you might have an investment advisor that wants to be prudent, but the top management of the investment company might want to swing some of the investments to things that are more lucrative to the firm, and so you have those kind of clashes. You even have the clash in hedge fund trading, where you might have hedge fund traders who are particularly aggressive, but you have a manager that is running kind of risk formulas, trying to calculate the overall risk for the firm, and might need to put some brakes on a very aggressive hedge fund trader who could be getting 80, 100% return on something they're particularly doing at the moment. Of course, their incentive is to do more of it and do more of it and double up and triple up on their bet. But the manager, the risk manager, is saying, wait a minute, too much of the overall firm's risk is in this one position, and if it suddenly goes south and turns around, we could be, right down the drain. So, yes, you have different, and sometimes organizations want to put those people in direct tension with one another, but they don't always explain it to the people in those jobs that they're doing that. So there's like a puppet master behind the scenes putting these people in tension with one another, who think of it as a personal fight or a fight of personality, when actually it's a fight in money cultures between the two different professions that the CEO may intentionally be putting in tension with one another.
How can understanding how people in different professions think about money inform any of us that interact with people in those professions? Say, just a salesman calls you up and wants to sell you something. If you understand their money culture, how does that benefit me as a potential consumer?
Certainly as a consumer, knowing exactly what's motivating the salesperson can certainly help you both understand their pitch and maybe even also get you a better deal. Everybody knows the idea about a car salesman trying to meet that month's quota, and maybe you can get a better deal at one time of the month versus another, that sort of thing. There are sometimes times in which salespeople are trying to make a trip. In other words, if they sell a certain amount of product by a certain deadline, they get to go on a fancy trip. Sometimes you can get salesmen to actually talk about that with you and get on the inside of that. I know a lot of restaurants will do that. So, for example, a restaurant owner and a food product salesman can get very close to one another, and the food product salesman can say, look, we have a contest going on in which I have to sell you this degreaser, and it's the last thing the restaurant owner might want to buy. But he'll say, I'll take the degreaser if you can give me a discount on this. And they'll actually negotiate some kind of a trade-off in which both parties benefit to some degree. So if you really want to do some inside baseball, you can do that often with salespeople. With investment advisors, it's always important to know where it is they're drawing their money from. So you always want to know where their fees are coming from and whether they're pushing you into an investment that you shouldn't be in. Even debt counselors, it's really important to know if a debt counselor is working for a not-for-profit credit counseling agency or a for-profit credit counseling agency, because you will get very different treatment at a very vulnerable place in your life if you're at a for-profit center rather than a not-for-profit credit counseling service. But even bankers, if you think about bankers, we were talking about bankers earlier, there was a time in which many, many bankers were suggesting to people that they roll all kinds of debt into home equity loans and second mortgages. And that can be very smart at some times because of tax implications, but can be very unwise at other times because you may be putting your home at risk with all that debt, which began as maybe a student loan or some other kind of loan. You're rolling it all into a home equity loan that's backed up by your house. That might not be such a good idea for people who are at some vulnerable financial place in their life. And you might not realize that the bank customer service rep is trying to sell you that because they're getting a commission on that or they're getting a bonus on that. And that might not be the best thing for you to do at a given moment in your life.
We have an email from Rona who gives an example of how the work that she does has impacted her attitudes towards money. She says, as a freelance writer, I wrote a number of articles for business magazines around building credit scores, how to get out of being house poor, and how to recover from a catastrophic loss like a foreclosure. Because of this, I have been ridiculously hesitant to buy a house, get a credit card, or otherwise go into any sort of debt. Now that my husband and I are finally feeling ready to buy a home, I'm fighting to build a decent credit score because I have no good credit to build it. Sometimes knowing too much can hurt you, especially when dealing with money.
That's a funny comment from Rona. She probably never expected as a writer to know so much about FICO scores and all that sort of thing. I agree. The more I learned about FICO scores, the more frightened I became of everything I did, because you find out, you know, if you take on too many credit cards, that can be bad. And you do get very gun-shy about what you're doing, and then you might fail to build credit that you need later on. There's also been a bit of a backlash among a lot of sociologists who think that the whole idea of home ownership may have been a bit oversold to people who have very low or fairly low incomes, that people didn't appreciate the real carrying costs of owning your own home, and some may have actually been better off renting at those inflated home prices. So it is a complicated world out there to know what's best, and you get advice from so many people that always have their own interests mixed in with that. So I certainly sympathize with Rona. It's like a little information was maybe too much of a good thing for her.
It sort of comes with the territory for a sociologist to seek out common themes, make generalizations.
Right.
But aren't there exceptions? I mean, aren't there conservative poker players and financial advisors who take big risks and so forth?
There are. There were a number of things that actually surprised me. There are, of course, exceptions to all these rules. And there were things that just out and out surprised me. For example, I found a number of poker players to actually be quite careful with their money, especially the ones that have been doing it for a long time. I'm talking about the real professionals that are trying to make a living as poker players. Some of them are very careful with their money because they've come to live through some of those swings I described earlier, and they put their money money aside very, very cautiously, and they know the value of everything they're buying. So things can even change over the course of one person's life. And yes, there are investment advisors that do all kinds of wild things with it, and some of those exceptions are understandable. In fact, one of the investment advisors I spoke with that took a number of risks, the one reason he cited for doing that was that he had several college friends that had made a lot more money than him. And when he would go to a college reunion, one of his friends who had started and owned his own company would come and pick everybody else up in his own private plane. And this cautious investment advisor, who earned a very good living but not like his friend, took a couple of wild swings for home runs that he probably shouldn't have. And it came, I think, fundamentally from his small reference group and how he felt in relation to a couple of his buddies that had made a lot more money than him, even though he had done very well. So yes, of course, there are exceptions to all these rules. These are just kind of tendencies. I mean, think about clergy. I have a chapter on clergy. And if you think about how different types of clergy can be one from another, I talked a little bit about some of the priests that operate in an almost cashless society. And then you have clergy that are part of what people have dubbed a bit derisively the prosperity theology, where they're preaching the idea of if you do the right things, God will actually make you rich. So if you think of the vast terrain that clergy cover in their attitudes toward money, you'll see that that there are some real differences among a profession.
Kevin Delaney is a professor of sociology at Temple University. He's also vice dean for faculty affairs in the College of Liberal Arts at Temple and the author of the book Money at Work, On the Job with Priests, Poker Players, and Hedge Fund Traders. Kevin, thanks for talking with us today.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. Remember, you can hear this program twice each day on WILL AM 580. It airs live at 10 a.m., then is rebroadcast each weeknight at 8 p.m. Now, an exception to that rule will be tomorrow night when Focus is preempted by NPR's live coverage of the first of the presidential debates. But most nights, you can tune in at 8 o'clock to hear the program again. Or if you know somebody who might enjoy hearing the program but is unable to do so weekday mornings at 10, be sure to let them know about our nightly rebroadcasts at 8 o'clock. If you know anyone who might enjoy hearing Focus who lives outside of our listening area, let them know we stream the program live every day at will.illinois.edu. You can also listen back to past programs, and Focus is also available as a free downloadable podcast. On tomorrow's show, we'll welcome your questions about the care and feeding of your pets, from dogs and cats to birds to gerbils and hamsters to, well, whatever animal companions may be cavorting around your house. We'll welcome your questions for Julia Whittington, director of the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine's Wildlife Clinic, and Brendan McKiernan, a professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Illinois. That's on Wednesday's program. Today's show is produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen.